take it over to the right.
Good morning, everyone. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. Members, we have the minutes of the last meeting of March 5th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of March 5th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay, members, we've got two items of business this morning. We're going to get a review of the tax conformity issue from Joel Michael, and then we're going to get a review of our pension systems here in Minnesota. Both of these, I think, are big issues that are coming before the legislature. And while we don't have bills in front of us today, I felt that we should get some information about these ahead of time so people have a little bit more background on them as we move forward into the session. Then after session today, pending re-referral on the floor, we're going to take up House File 3147, which is the MNLARS funding bill. Tentatively, I'm thinking it'll be 5 o'clock in this room. GOP members will have a caucus before them that'll announce on the floor, but, of course, subject to what goes on the floor, it could be later, could be earlier. We'll certainly get things done as quick as we can. So with that, unless there's any questions about the schedule, we will turn it over to Joel Michael. Mr. Michael, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Joel Michael from House Research. With me, I have Sean Williams, who's the other person in House Research that works on income tax issues. He does our modeling, and so if I make misstatements, he's going to stop me if he can.
Welcome, what, Mr. Williams.
What I'm going to do, recognizing that this is the Ways and Means Committee and not the Taxes Committee, I'm going to try to do three sort of high-level background pieces on federal conformity. The first thing I'm going to do is just to talk about some basics about how federal conformity works. I think, you know, since the legislature almost routinely has passed conformity bills, most of you probably know this, but when I've gotten a few questions from members recently, I've discovered that that knowledge is not as good as I necessarily thought it was. And so I think it's useful to sort of go back over that those basics. Then I'd like to talk about what would happen if the legislature does not pass conformity. What's the impact on the state budget? I realize that some of that goes over what MMB talked to you about last week when they went over the forecast, but I'll try to not duplicate what they said and provide a little bit more detail. Finally, the last thing I want to do is to talk about some general budget issues related to the conformity legislation. So what are the basics on federal conformity? Like almost all states, I think universally, there are a few states that do not link themselves to the federal tax, but Minnesota and almost all states do, and the states that don't still administratively do it. So Minnesota links it, both its individual income and its corporate franchise taxes, directly to federal tax. Under our Constitution, Minnesota is one of several states that does not permit that to be done automatically or on a rolling basis. In a court decision called the Wallace case back in the 70s, the 60s legislature tried to do that, to say that if Congress changes the law, that automatically changes Minnesota law the way it's linked to federal law. The Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that because that would delegate your legislative authority to Congress to change the tax law. So effectively what we have to do is to have a static or fixed link to federal law. So when you see the bills, they always say as amended through December, you know, the current linkage is as amended through December 16th, 2016. And that's generally referred to static conformity, not rolling conformity. There are a number of states that use rolling conformity either because their constitution explicitly permits it or because their courts have said that it's okay. So it's crucial to know where this linkage to federal law is. Minnesota uses federal taxable income. The flow chart that you see up on the in your materials and up on the monitor shows the mechanics of calculating federal and state income taxes and where the linkage is. So at the very top, you can see the Internal Revenue Code says, you know, income from whatever source derived is taxable. That's gross income. So it's all kinds of income, wages, capital gains, dividends, interest, and so forth. Then you subtract in that calculation business losses and so forth, and then below that is what are called above-the-line deductions. This is where you take things like contributions to IRAs, moving expenses, student loan interest, and so forth. After you do that, you get to adjusted gross income. That's the place where most states tie themselves to federal law. Minnesota did that through 1987. After the 86 federal reform, the 87 legislature decided to link to the next box below that, the federal taxable income. So what's the difference between adjusted gross income and federal taxable income? That's where you subtract either standard or itemized deductions and personal and dependent exemptions. At that point, the two taxes deviate from each other. So what's done below that? Two things. You apply the rates to the base, so federal rate changes don't affect us, or you allow credits, and federal credits don't affect Minnesota tax. But everything above that does affect Minnesota tax on a, you know, again, on a static basis because they're in calculation of federal taxable income. So if you follow the flow chart over to the right, Minnesota then adds some things that aren't in federal taxable income and subtracts some things that are in federal taxable income. Some of those are required by federal law. We can't tax U.S. bond interest, for example. Some of them are just decisions the legislature has made that they wanted, to accept some things from Minnesota tax that the federal doesn't. Then we apply our rates and allow our credits. So that's the mechanics of how this all works. So what does that really mean? It means that we are linked to federal decisions about itemized and standard deductions and personal and dependent exemptions. Now, this is important because of the changes that the 2017 tax bill, the federal tax bill, makes. Typically, the legislature, as I'm sure all of you know, regularly passes conformity bills as every, you know, as Congress changes the law. You all enact legislation that updates our linkage to federal law so the tax stays relatively simple, makes it easy for taxpayers and the DOR. So what's in the 2017 Federal Tax Act? In the past, we've had, for the last 20 years, we've had largely updates to federal changes that are fairly modest. It's this extender package that I think would be best characterized as what Congress has been doing because of their budget rules. They enact short-term tax cuts because they don't want to recognize the full 10-year cost of the budget cut. So then they keep extending them every couple years, and so you all have then adopted those changes. Well, 2017 bill is a total game changer by comparison. It makes profound changes in the federal income and corporate taxes. It's a large federal tax cut, about somewhere $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion, depending upon how you score it. It's mainly a business tax cut. There are modest individual tax cuts, and it totally redoes the way foreign operations are taxed. So it reduces federal revenue by that $1.5 trillion roughly, but the changes are more substantial than that because they're offset by base expansions, both on the individual side and on the business side. And many of those changes affect federal taxable income, or FTI, which, going back to that before. So what are some of those changes that affect FTI that you will be deciding about? There's a large increase in the standard deduction. And they totally repeal the personal and dependent exemptions. So that's the way the federal tax and our tax has been adjusted for the size of a family. Obviously, they're not going to not have a family size adjustment at the federal level. What they did was they moved it downstream, going back to that flow chart. Instead of having an exemption amount, now they have a way more generous child credit that offsets that. But we're not linked to the child credit, so your conformity bill is going to have to decide how you're going to replace that repeal dependent exemption. There are a host of business changes that affect FTI. They go in both directions, but overall they're largely base expansions, not contractions, because Congress was trying to use this to pay for reductions in the rate. The big change that they made was a reduction in the corporate rate from 35 to 21. That doesn't affect us because on that flow chart that's down below FTI. And they also, for pass-through businesses, enacted this 20% deduction, that what's called QBI, qualified business income. That will affect us if we stay with FTI. So what are the state budget and tax system impacts if you don't enact the conformity bill this session? So what happens automatically? And this, I won't duplicate what MMB talked about in terms of the forecast, but in general, there are broad economic effects of passage of this federal tax legislation. So it affects growth assumptions. Those have been incorporated by IHS into the variables that are given to MMB and have shown up in the forecast. There are also behavioral responses to the federal legislation. So, for example, MMB has talked to you about there, because of the changes in the foreign income provisions, there are many corporations that are going to voluntarily repatriate some of their deferred foreign earnings, and that will result in capital gains and dividend income that MMB has added to the underlying forecast. We also know from reading the newspaper and from the information that revenue is collected that a lot of people prepaid their property taxes in 2017, their 2018, and so that's going to affect, and they've taken that into, people are also prepaying charitable contributions, so all those things are built into the February forecast. There is this one issue that I'd like to talk a little bit more about, which is what's called the consistent election issue. If you read the forecast document, you will see that it shows up. As I said before, we've got a static linkage to federal law that says our tax base is based on 2016 federal law. So we don't pick up this increase in the standard deduction automatically. But our law says that when you file your Minnesota return, you have to use the same elections that you use for federal purposes. That mainly affects things like depreciation and a lot of other business provisions. But one thing that you need to elect is whether you're going to claim the itemized deductions or standard deduction. And the Department of Revenue has, over in the past, read that to require, without regard to what version of federal law that applies. And in this case, that's going to mean that if that holds true, which that's clearly Revenue's position, that's going to mean somebody, a taxpayer who benefits from the federal standard from the increase in the federal standard deduction because it's higher than their itemized deductions, and that will lower their federal tax, will also have to elect to take the standard deduction for Minnesota purposes, even though it would be more advantageous for them in calculating Minnesota tax because that requires them to use the old federal standard deduction. So for a married couple, it's $13,000 versus $24,000. The revenue interpretation says that they would have to use that $13,000 amount, even though we're linked to old federal law. That has a big impact, and I'll show you the numbers in a little bit, which appeared in the forecast document.
Mr. Michael, can I ask you a question about that? So I guess just this is a big issue, and you said that in the past the Department of Revenue has said that they'll treat the election issue that way, too, and you know, other changes to federal law, I guess, but, you know, one's not nearly this big. Now, I know you earlier referenced the Wallace decision that basically said the federal government can't essentially change state law. Has anyone ever litigated that election issue in terms of saying, you know, well, this is a change in federal law, too? I mean, or is that an outstanding potential legal issue?
Mr. Chairman, no. To my knowledge, no one has ever litigated that issue. And in the past, it's always been a minor issue. We had 1 year where the federal standard deduction for married couples was higher than it was for Minnesota purposes because the legislature failed to pass a conformity bill. So on the standard deduction side, that's the one instance where I know that that came up. But the dollar amounts, I mean, we were talking hundreds of, you know, a few hundred dollars in tax liability. It's not the sort of thing that anyone would sue about. I do think there, certainly the plain reading of the language of the statute supports the DOR view because it's not, it's not clearly linked to the election made under old or new federal law. I think there's a statutory construction argument that you could make that, no, the legislature, when it enacted this, did not envision requiring this sort of election where Congress effectively said, in order to get a federal, it de facto, what you would be saying is Congress was saying that if you want to get a tax cut, you're going to have to pay a federal tax cut. You're going to have to pay more for state purposes, that the legislature really didn't intend that. And you can imagine in some cases Congress may repeal an election that's required, so it would be physically impossible under new federal law to make an election in order to get a tax benefit you were entitled to under state law under old federal law. It's unclear to me how the courts would resolve that, but DOR has said they're going to follow the plain language of the law and require this. And so what that means is if you don't take action, there will be a tax increase for these affected filers. And there's a handful of people where it's actually going to be advantageous for them to pay more federal tax, to pay even less state tax. So that's sort of an unusual circumstance where we would actually be benefiting the federal government, says sort of can't ever think of a time when we've done something like that.
Well, just for members so they understand this. I mean, you know, as I understand where this becomes complicated is let's say a person has $20,000 in itemized deductions and they would take the $20,000. They've been taking their $20,000 in itemized deductions at the federal level and thus they've been getting credit for $20,000 in itemized deductions at the state level. Now, all of a sudden, you've got a $24,000 standard deduction at the federal level. So they would say, well, now I'll no longer itemize at the federal level. I'll take the standard deduction because I get a bigger deduction. But they only get then the $13,000 standard deduction at the state level, which is what our current standard deduction is. So they would, as Mr. Michael says, get a benefit and pay less tax at the federal level, but now at the state level, because of this election issue, because they take the $24,000 standard deduction at the federal level, now they are electing, as our Department of Revenue defines it, to take the $13,000 lower standard deduction at the state level and thus be paying more state tax than they would have before. And that's And I think a lot of people here understand that, but just for those of us who haven't heard Mr. Michael on numerous occasions in the Tax Committee over the last few weeks, I thought I would just bring that up as an example. Because it is an issue where there are people that will pay more in state tax and less in federal tax as things are now. Go ahead, Mr. Michael. I don't have any questions.
Yes. One of the things that sort of mitigates a little bit that effect is that by taking the standard deduction, Minnesota law has a non-itemizer charitable contribution subtraction that people will then qualify for. That subtraction is not as generous as the itemized deduction for charitable contributions because The first $500 is not deductible or subtractable, and only half of the contributions over that. But that effect in combination actually offsets a bunch of the increase. So this table that you see on the slide that's up on the screen now shows the first row, these are the numbers that MMB has incorporated into their forecast. So this effect that the chair was just talking about, in general, it typically is estimated to increase taxes by about $60 million a year. Then this second feature, the fact that that will allow these people, in many cases, to get an offsetting non-itemized or charitable deduction, reduces that by $33 to $34 million. So the net tax increases in the $26 to $28 million increase.
Excuse me, I've got a question from Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Michael. So back to that discussion we're having with the chair here. Mr. Michael, wouldn't we have the same increase in state revenue or loss of deductions for somebody who chose the standard deduction on the federal level, because it also relates to the old standard deduction on the old form? So regardless of their federal election, they're going to lose out. Is that accurate or not?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, the way DOR is interpreting and has applied this provision is that if you elect, as the chair pretty clearly laid out, if you elect the federal standard deduction, then you have to also elect the Minnesota standard deduction, which is that lower amount. And then doing that entitles you then to this charitable contribution subtraction if you have, sufficient contributions to qualify for it. So that, the two are, in the Department of Revenue's interpretation, the two are directly linked. You can argue, the natural argument to make if you're a taxpayer who's adversely affected by this is, no, when the legislature enacted this, what it really meant was to link it to an election you made under that version of federal law. And you did not elect the standard deduction under that version of federal law, and so that's why you're not going to elect it for Minnesota purposes. That's contrary to just a straight reading of the language of that sentence, maybe, but maybe it's implied. And you can imagine making arguments that, the legislature, by doing this, sort of let Congress change Minnesota law and delegated its power away. I don't know. It's unclear exactly how that comes out. You can avoid any of this occurring by enacting conformity legislation this year.
So Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Michael, any just kind of ballpark guess on this election or non-election difference, if you will, if we don't conform versus if we do conform, what amount of the federal what amount of the increase in state income or on the individual side, is this 80 or 90% of the individual income tax increase?
The Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, the table on the slide shows the best estimate of what the revenue effect of this is. The standard deduction and personal exemption changes have like $1 billion a year. Mr. Williams has the numbers here. On net, it's over $260 million a year. So this this is actually not incorporated into this. This is very confusing. This is in the forecast. These numbers are in the forecast. And then separately, passing conformity legislation on the standard deduction and so forth is, another $260 million in revenue. So I'm sure this is going to be a source of confusion for the Taxes Committee as we go through a conformity bill, and then ultimately for the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Please proceed, Mr. Michael.
So basically, what are the impact? The next thing I'd like to talk about just in the last part on this is what's the impact on the tax system itself if you don't enact conformity legislation in 2018. The obvious thing, it's going to be way more complex for taxpayers than the Department of Revenue. And that's because for Minnesota purposes, taxpayers would have to compute their tax the way old federal law was, whereas they compute their federal tax under current federal law. And that's just a way more complex, and there, in my mind, there's some things that it's not at all clear that how exactly you would do it. Those costs, I think you can conceptually think of as a tax. It doesn't generate revenue to the state, but it increases the cost of people complying with the tax system. Nobody wants to spend money on tax compliance, and so that's money that's just basically lost or like a tax. And like I said, for some cases, it's hard for me to even envision how this occurs. The federal rules, for example, will allow a lot more businesses to use cash basis accounting. That's the basic building block of the tax system. Minnesota law would require them to continue to use accrual basis accounting. I don't know how, you know, in that case, you would, some people would have income in 1 year for state purposes and income in a later year for federal purposes. It would be a nightmare of complexity. So going on, we've talked about the consistent election rule. Basically, that's sort of an automatic tax increase. And in fact, as I suggested, there will be some taxpayers who would actually will be advantageous for them to pay higher federal taxes in order to pay lower Minnesota taxes. The typical situation where this would be occur is somebody who has itemized deductions that are still allowed for federal purposes but are very close to the $24,000 level of the new federal standard deduction for married joint filers. I think revenue has estimated the numbers on this. I think it's like $3 million or something like that. Failing to pass conformity will make it more expensive for software companies to build their Minnesota tax modules. I could imagine for some smaller ones that don't have much market, they may actually, I could imagine them simply saying, hey, we're not going to do that anymore. It's not worth it. And I guarantee that there will be taxpayers, if this happens, that will simply say, I'm not going to do it because it's not practical, and I expect that the legislature will retroactively fix this. So last thing I'd like to talk about is just conformity legislations and some of the dynamics of that. Yes, it's pretty clear that I've been trying to stress the idea that it's probably got severe negative ramifications if the legislature does not act during 2018, because these federal changes, virtually all of them, there's a few of them that are effective for 2017, but most of them are effective for the current tax year. So if you don't act during 2018, taxpayers will be forced to deal with that situation on the Department of Revenue. And because these changes are so far-reaching and sweeping, early action is better than late action. In fact, I think that, you know, might be people, I've heard talk about a special session to deal with this. I think if you tried to do this in August or something like that, it would, the less lead time that DOR and the software companies and taxpayers have, the more problematic it is. By comparison with recent conformity bills, which have been fairly simple because they're mainly extending small tax cuts, this is way more complex because it's changing all sorts of rules that determine how you measure the tax base. So some basic discussion about these federal changes. They're updating to the federal changes provides a bigger tax base because Congress disallowed a bunch of deductions and exemptions and so forth. That If you look at the Department of Revenue's revenue estimate, that shows an increase in state revenue, but that's not sort of money that's just dropping out of the sky. That's because if you update to those changes without making offsetting changes, people will pay higher taxes. Minnesota individuals and businesses will pay higher taxes. So you're going to have to, so the natural thing to do is to say, look, we can make offsetting changes that don't make this a tax increase. And that, you can say you're going to do that on an overall basis, and but if you do that and you sort of just follow these new federal rules and make a few changes, like cut the rates or restore, you got to somehow replace those repealed dependent and personal exemptions, there are going to be winners and losers. So a conformity bill, I think you have to recognize, if you do something that keeps the tax simple and easy to administer, there are going to be more winners and losers. But even if you say, we want to avoid that, we're going to enact a tax that preserves the itemized deductions, uses the old federal standard deduction, replaces the personal independent exemptions, you're still going to have winners and losers because of all of these business changes that you're somehow going to have to conform to. Yet you can minimize winners and losers, but you cannot eliminate them. I guess that's the bottom line message. Other budgeting things to be concerned about. A lot of this projected revenue is one time. The repatriation tax, for those of you who've heard about this, Congress has switched the foreign tax rules from being a worldwide system with a tax offsetting tax credit and deferral of foreign earnings to a territorial system where only U.S. income is largely going to be taxed. But the price that it extracted for doing that is saying that all of this, and to provide revenue to provide these federal rate cuts, it said all of that income, that deferred foreign income that was taxable in that period between 1987 and 2017, you have to pay tax on that. And under Minnesota law, the way it's structured now, if we conform, we're going to tax that income. But that's a one-time event. Congress allows that to be paid over 8 years. Revenues estimate assumes that you all, if you enact a conformity bill, would also do that over 8 years. That actually takes a specific act to make that happen, but that's a one-time event, whether it occurs in 1 year or over 8 years. There are actually some provisions that look like they raise revenue in our forecast window, but over the 10 years of the federal estimate actually lose revenue. Again, these are foreign provisions. The other thing is that almost all of the individual income tax changes are temporary. You know, for those of you who follow this in the media, they expire after tax year 2025. Now, the congressional leaders that are behind this have said, no, this is not going to be temporary. We're going to extend this. And so I'm sure that there's a good probability that that will happen, just like we had the extender legislation that regularly extended those tax cuts that were enacted 15, 20 years ago and have been extended in 1 and 2 year intervals since then that you've been conforming to. It's sort of likely, I think, that that will happen to those changes. And I think from a budgeting perspective, since these one-time revenues, you need to think about, are you going to make permanent changes or authorize long-term budget effects based on those that you will have, that a future legislature will then have to deal with when that revenue is no longer there. Just want to talk a little bit about the uncertainty that's involved with these revenue estimates that DOR provides that all of these bills will be based on. They're basically,
excuse me, Mr. Michael, before you do that, so just to put what you said in perspective, so I mean, for those of us who are still here 4 or 5 years from now, when they're doing a budget forecast, all this is going to be forecasted to change back to the federal tax law, and the revenue is then going to, what, for example, in repatriation, assume that we lose a whole bunch of revenue in, let's say, the out years when we get to 2022 or something? Is that right? Or what will happen?
Mr. Chairman, there will, yes, these, the MMB forecasts are always based on current law. So depending upon how you're linked to federal law, and these things go two ways. So the repatriation tax is a one-time thing. So at the when that eight-year period ends, that suddenly the underlying revenue forecast of revenues will drop. The expiration of some of these things, like the increase in the standard deduction and some of the other, the increase in the standard deduction, of course, being the poster child for this, if you conform to that increase in the standard deduction, the MMB forecast will indicate that when that expires for federal purposes, you will have that revenue because that's what current law is. And that's the way the extenders work. So then the legislature will be forced with the decision. I have slides that talk a little bit more about this in the future. Then a future legislature will say, are we going to extend that tax cut? And if so, how are we going to pay for it out of our budget? Because unlike Congress, you can't deficit spend.
Well, this is getting pretty far in the future, so I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it, but it is interesting. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, it may not be as far in the future as some of us may think. When you look at when the forecasts and when those laws expire, it would show up first in the November forecast of 23, I'm assuming, if Congress hasn't acted and they act late, and then the November or the February forecast in 24. So that's, in terms of long-range planning, in all likelihood, we'll have forecasts that will be current law without federal law changes if we look at the history of Congress acting at the last minute.
Well, and I'm wondering if it might even show up a little bit earlier than that just because of the tails. You know, going out 4 years. But anyway, yeah, Mr.
Karen, that's a good point. I wasn't thinking of the tails, but just the forecast. Yeah. But if you talk the tails, then it would be even earlier.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, Mr. Michael, if we moved the reference to adjusted gross income, which there is some discussion about that, two questions. One, how much of this would we have avoided having to discuss here today in this session had we been at AGI? And then secondly, if we do go to AGI, will it help mitigate problems in 2023 or 2025 if some weird things happen on the federal level?
Not Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Druskowski, many of these changes are because we're using FDI rather than AGI. There are only six states that are like Minnesota on the individual side that use FDI. So the big change, you would have not been affected by the 20% business deduction, the change in the standard deduction, the change in itemized deductions, and the personal independent exemptions. And so we haven't, Sean and I haven't calculated the numbers, but that's, you know, the overwhelming part of this, of the base changes in this bill. The base changes that affect AGI are mainly business changes and of much lesser import. So that's the answer. Your second question, the answer is yes. If you switch now to AGI, you will avoid this cliff effect because the standard deduction, you know, sort of ratcheting back to the lower level, which I think most taxpayers would say if you were tied to the new higher standard deduction, they would view that as a tax increase, even though the law says that that's the law that's in effect. And if you don't do anything, that's what happens. So the, you know, whoever succeeds you, or you're young enough, you may still be around here, will be faced with that, with that decision in 2024 or whenever that happens. So how reliable are these revenue estimates? They're done sort of two ways. We have an income tax model that has a sample of tax returns. A bunch of these things can be calculated that way, and so those numbers are fairly reliable. There's a lot of these things, though, that involve information that's not on tax returns and or things where behavior and economic responses occur to those. The congressional economists do their best to estimate that, and then DOR takes those numbers and apportions them to Minnesota. In my judgment, these estimates are not quite as reliable because they involve more reliance on assumptions and economic theory, and in part because Minnesota may not always closely reflect what's going on nationally. One thing that we noticed in looking at NCSL information is that Arizona, when they do their estimates, is sufficiently concerned about that they actually apply a 25% discount rate to those federal estimates. We've never done that in Minnesota, and I've never heard of any other state doing that, so I'm not recommending that, but it says something about the reliability and uncertainty that's involved. In particular, I would say, there are some really unique and difficult provisions to estimate in the federal bill. This 20% deduction for pass-through entities and the international provisions are the ones that leap out. It's just unclear what the behavioral responses will be to some of these things, and for some of them, I'm sure the data is not that good either. And I will say they audited it. The predecessor to the 20% deduction was a 9% deduction for domestic production. Minnesota did not follow that, but the congressional estimators ended up being estimating one-third of the cost of that, in part because there were many more businesses that used it than they thought would, and the courts reversed a bunch of IRS decisions as well. So, again, we've talked a little bit about these provisions that are temporary, and I guess I'll skip through it. I think I've gone through virtually all of this stuff, and so I'll, in responding to questions. But basically, if you switch to AGI, you will avoid many of these, sort of problems that would occur when Congress partially extends, or whatever it does with, particularly the standard deduction. But that's, as it's been clear, is 4 or 5 years down the road. With that, I'll stop unless there are any other questions.
Mr. Michael, do you have any sense, of course it depends on what we do in terms of conformity, but I mean when you talk about the uncertainty of some of these estimates, I mean do you have any sense if the uncertainty is more on the revenue raising side, that if things, were wrong we'd end up with more revenue than we thought, or are they on the other side that if things went wrong they're likely to be on the less revenue than we thought? Or is it just impossible to say?
I think it's really hard to say for sure, but my instinct is that the downside risk is greater than the upside potential for this reason. The itemized deduction changes and the standard deduction and the repeal of the personal exemptions are the big changes that are fairly reliable and easy to estimate because they're based on tax return information. The allowance of the 20% deduction for pass-through entities and some of the other business changes have very large behavioral components that are difficult to know how people are going to respond to that. And those are on the downside, whereas the changes to repealing the personal exemptions, that's fairly confident because it's like, how many people are there? So that my instinct would be that there's more downside risk, but that's just intuition on my part.
Right. Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I wonder if Mr. Michael could expand a little bit on page 16 where you say late summer or fall special session passage is problematic. What I'm asking here is not so much whether there is going to be a special session or not. We can't, anybody here, including Mr. Michael, probably predict that. But what would be the absolute deadline to have something passed into law so the software companies, Department of Revenue, and Minnesota Management and Budget could have everything prepared without any problems filtering down to the businesses and individual taxpayers?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, that's probably a better question to ask Commissioner Bowerly, but I know that the software companies, given the scope of the changes involved here, you know, really like to have the federal drafts of the state forms in August, and that, you know, and you can sort of walk that back and say, gee, that sort of means that DOR needs to know what the law is in June or some, you know, because they're just, you know, fairly significant form changes that are involved that have to be incorporated. But I'm really not competent to respond to that, except that having talked to them, I know that they're very concerned if things push to the late summer or fall.
And Mr. Chairman, when you do reference June, understanding that others probably have a better handle, that would mean that we would probably be best without a special session and trying to get some of this done before we adjourn in late May.
I doubt anyone here wants a special session.
Well, I'm not accusing anybody of wanting it. I'm just saying that we have a tight timeline here that has to be met without creating future problems.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Michaels, Mr. Williams. So we've heard more of the complexities of conforming and whether or not people will choose to use the standard deduction or the itemized deduction. And we talk about the behavioral effects and the incentive effects. Couldn't we offer some stability in giving serious thought to overall lowering the income tax rates to mitigate some of those and offer some stability into the predictability of your models? What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, I think you're going to be faced with this sort of financial dynamic that if you want to, first of all, I think you're going to need to decide how you're going to do a family size adjustment for the tax, which means that you will either want to because it's no longer in federal taxable income, assuming you're going to use that, you're going to want to allocate money to essentially replicate that deduction that was available before. Then you're going to have a second question about, gee, do you want to have Minnesota have a materially lower standard deduction and have a fair number of taxpayers itemizing for Minnesota purposes that don't do that for federal purposes? If you decide that you want to do the higher federal standard deduction because of that and replace the personal exemptions, you won't have much, you will not have money left to individual base expansions to pay for rate cuts unless you actually take some of the money that comes from business-based expansions and use it to pay for those rate cuts.
All right. Seeing no further questions, Mr. Michael, Mr. Williams, thank you very much. If we could have the representatives from the Pension Commission, Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth, come forward.
Okay, we can just go ahead. Let's try this.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While they're getting set up, I would just like to remind the committee that, and I think Chair Carlson had some great comments there, that if we don't get this done by the adjournment of session, and the department's put in a situation where they have to figure as if we do nothing, and then, yeah, we may still do something. They'll spend thousands of hours working on keeping things the way they are versus the changes that we would make. So I think it's in everybody's best interest to do this sooner rather than later. And I do want to thank the Department of Revenue, Chair Marquardt, the governor, for working with us on this. We've been working on this for a long, long time behind the scenes, and now you're going to see some things moving quite quickly. So it's very, very important this gets done yet this session. Otherwise, the departments could be in quite, not that they couldn't do it, they can do all sorts of good things, but it makes, puts a lot more stress on them.
Well, thank you, Chair Davids. I was remiss in not recognizing you at the end as the tax chair to make any comments you might have wanted to make. So thanks for raising your hand and making your comments. And members, as we're getting the Pension Commission presentation set up, let me just say that I think a lot of you know the Pension Commission has been, the Legislative Pension Commission has been working on a proposal that they've come a long way with. This is, they may say a few things about that today, but we're really, I would ask them to focus just on a general overview of our pension system and where we were. You know, presuming that the Pension Commission does pass that legislation and it goes through the committee process, we'll eventually get it and have a full discussion on it. But I felt that just in preparation for that, and because pensions are such an important part of the overall state financial picture, that we ought to have a presentation on it just in general, and then to have people prepped, presuming we get some sort of other pension bill later.
If they got it there.
They're trying to get some money for vocational education.
And otherwise, I think everyone's got the handouts, right?
Amazingly well prepared.
Yeah, we could go ahead and just, oh, there we go. Bingo. All right. Okay. Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Susan Lincheski. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Seated next to me is Rachel Barth, the Deputy Director. We're going to pass this presentation back and forth. I'll start out, and then Rachel will take a few slides, and then if that's all right, I'll come back to finish it off. Moving to page 2.
I don't ask you much.
Let's see.
Yep. I just wish it was somebody besides Joe Brown.
I know.
I hate it.
Oh, I'll also note that there are a couple of handouts in addition to the PowerPoint. Okay, just trying to figure out the technology. We have a couple of handouts. The first is a colorful yellow and white handout, which is our, we call it our pension plan basics. It provides a lot of demographic and sort of basic information about the pension plans in the state of Minnesota. And then the second item is a handout on the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. It provides the list of our current members, some history, what the commission does, when it meets, procedural matters. So starting in, I'll just describe real basically the way our pension system and really the retirement system in the state of Minnesota breaks out. There are two types of pension plans or retirement plans. One is the defined benefit pension plan. That is the one that's really foremost in everybody's minds because the state is required to fund that plan in order to provide the benefits that are determined using a formula. So there's no investment risk on the part of the members. They are simply entitled to a benefit that's determined based on a formula that in turn is based on years of service, pay, and then a factor or a multiple. That type of benefit is typically paid out as an annuity. So the state is then required to fund that. The second type of plan, which the state also has and offers to its employees, is a defined contribution plan. That plan is simply based on the account and the investment returns on that account, and that's typically paid out in a lump sum. So there's contributions that goes into this plan, into an account, in the participant or the member's name, and then when they retire or terminate employment, they're entitled to that account.
So I'm just going to give you an overview of what types of plans we have in Minnesota. A majority of our pension plans are coordinated, which means the members also are covered by and contribute to Social Security. So, for example, MSRS, para-general plans, MSRS, para-correctional plans, TRA, St. Paul teachers, judges, and unclassified plan, all of those members contribute to Social Security, and all of the employers contribute to Social Security on their behalf. The employee contribution for Social Security is 6.2%, and the employer is 6.2% of pay. And these contributions are made in addition to what the employee and employer contribute to the pension plan. And if you look at the pension plan basic handout, you can see the contribution rates for each plan. And we have indicated if the plan is coordinated with Social Security or is basic. So basic plan means those members are not covered by and do not contribute to Social Security. There are just a few of them in the state, and those are mostly our public safety plans, so State Patrol and Police and Fire, and then the closed legislators plan. So, again, if you look at your plan basics handout, the second page, you'll see the basic plans, and generally the employee and employer contribute more to these plans and receive larger benefits because they don't have Social Security benefit to supplement their retirement income. This is their full retirement income. And just to make a quick little note, back on the first page, MSRS General, Parageneral, TRA, and St. Paul teachers do have some basic active and retiree members who were hired prior to the plans coordinating with Social Security. I think that was back in, like, the 70s. And you'll see those numbers. And these numbers do decrease each year because, like I said, all of those plans are now coordinated for new members. So for the next couple of slides, it would be helpful to reference that pension basics, which provides just more specific data on each plan as I kind of go through just generalized information. So state employees are covered by the Minnesota State Retirement System, MSRS. The general plan is the largest MSRS plan with about 50,000 active members. State patrol plan covers state patrol officers. The correctional plan covers correctional officers and other workers who have high contact rates with inmates in state correctional facilities. You have the judges plan, which are for judges, and the legislators plan, which is only covers legislators elected before June 30th, 1997. So those are all of the traditional defined benefit plans that MSRS administers. And then there's also the unclassified plan, which is a defined contribution plan that has a pension opt-out. So a member can elect to transfer to the general plan at a certain point in their career, depending on their hire date. And the unclassified plan covers legislators elected on or after July 1 of 97, legislative staff and constitutional officers, just to name a few. So public employees not employed by the state, so those who are employed by a county, a city, the school district, so non-teachers within the district, are covered by the Public Employees Retirement Association, or PARA. The general plan is the largest pension plan in the state. It has about 152,000 active members. We have the police and fire plan, which covers police officers and firefighters, and then the local government correctional plan, which covers correctional officers in city and county correctional facilities. And those three are the traditional defined benefit plans that PARA administers. And then PARA also administers a defined contribution plan. And this is a smaller plan that covers elected local government officials, city managers, and volunteer ambulance service personnel. So there are two teacher plans in our state. For teachers statewide, they are covered by the Teachers Retirement Association, or TRA. So that's about 81,000 active members. And this includes members of the former Minneapolis and Duluth teacher funds that merged into the plan in 06 and 2013-14. And then teachers in the St. Paul School District are covered by the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association, which is the last first-class city pension plan. And then all public employees, so state, county, city, and teachers, can contribute to what is the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan, which is a supplement to their main pension plan. And this is administered by MSRS. It's voluntary. Employees can contribute what they want up to certain maximums. And depending on where someone works, the employer can also contribute a certain amount on their behalf to the plan. So finally, we have the volunteer firefighter pensions, which are separate from the big plans. So relief associations are retirement plans that are run by the volunteer firefighters of a municipality with the oversight of the state auditor. There are about 650 of these relief associations in the state. Most are pension plans, and they provide either a lump sum payment at the time of retirement, or there are a few that offer a monthly annuity, so like a traditional defined benefit plan. And the rest are defined contribution plans. PARA also administers these plans under the statewide volunteer firefighter retirement plan. There are about 140 departments who have joined the plan, and they have the option to join this plan, so we're seeing a trend of them joining the PARA plan. And the pension plans provide either a lump sum or monthly annuities. And for these particular plans, they're funded by fire state aid, so not employee or employer contributions. Fire state aid is based on the insurance premiums on fire, lightning, sprinkler, and extended coverage insurance.
Ms. Barth, Representative Kahn is no longer a member of this committee. She'd probably ask some questions about that if she was here. But regarding the 650 firefighter relief associations, is the state liable for those if one of those would be underfunded or would go bankrupt? How does that work?
So, Mr. Chair, if a pension plan, let's say there's a bad investment year, the municipality is required to make a contribution to make the pension plan whole. So it's not the state, it's the individual municipality.
Okay.
I'll take over with slide number 10. Just a little bit of information on how these systems are, the governance structure and then the investment of the assets. Each pension system has its own board of directors or board of trustees. They are all fiduciaries, as is the executive director of each system. Each pension system also has its own actuary. It's an outside qualified actuary who performs annual valuations and then also every 4 years an experience study. Each plan is governed by the Minnesota statutes. That's an important distinction from private pension plans. Our terms and conditions, all the features of our benefit plans here are set forth in statute. So if there's a desire to change any of those, it does require legislative action. In a year like this year where we have seen the prior 2 years vetoes of the pension bill, there's a number of administrative and other sort of technical changes that have not been able to be made because of the vetoed bill. The assets of the plans, there's about $80 billion or so, that varies depending on investments, are invested by the State Board of Investment. Pension benefits, finally, I'll just note, are not subject to the collective bargaining process. So under our PELRA, or Public Employees Labor Relations Act, unions and employers do not bargain over these. This is solely in the realm of the legislature to fix these plans, make changes to the plans, whatever it is. Needs to come from the legislature. The sources of pension plan funding are, as Rachel mentioned, from the contributions being made. These are employee and employer contributions. In addition, there are contributions or contributions and direct payments that are being made by the state. In some cases, these relate back to plans that were acquired by, so in the case of the Duluth Teachers Plan, when that was acquired by the TRA, plan, there was a need for some funding, so there's special aids going into the teacher's retirement to pay for that. Finally, I guess with regard to the funded status, which relates closely to the contributions going in, that slide on which is slide number 12, does lay out the funded ratio for each of the plans as well as the contribution deficiency. Funded ratio is the ratio of assets to benefit liabilities. So if it were 100%, we would have enough assets to cover off current benefit liabilities and those projected into the future. All of the plans are falling short of that. Notably, the teachers' plans are in the 70% or lower range on the funded ratio. Contribution deficiency is an annual look at the plan, so it's looking at the dollars going into the plans and whether that's covering the value of the additional accrual for all members, as well as a portion of the underfunding. So the underfunding in the plans continues to grow because we have a contribution deficiency every year. So the impact of the underfunded pension plans, we get that question fairly frequently. Why do anything about these? Is it really necessary to get to 90% or 95%? What we are seeing is that the credit rating agencies do look at this and do take this into account in issuing their credit rating of the state, as well as these are for bond issues, as well as for the local, for municipalities, for instance. In the case of Minneapolis, there was some commentary from Moody's on the Minneapolis credit rating because of the pension liabilities. In addition, GASB, which is something the plans are now subject to, is the standards that apply to their financial statements. When a plan is underfunded, GASB makes it worse because it requires use of a lower assumed rate of return. So whereas for our actuarial reports, our plans are using 8% or 8.5%, hopefully soon to be reduced to 7.5% by our bill. In the case of GASB, those rates, the assumed rate of return is lower, making the funded ratio worse. That does play, Ben.
I'm sorry. Representative Fabian has got a question.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincheski, can you give me a little more detail on what that lowering of the assumed rate of return actually does in the net effect? And maybe you've got that in one of your later slides. I'm interested in the dollars.
Yeah, Representative Fabian. Yes, Chair. Thank you. I don't have that in a slide here, but the way it works is as the assumed rate of return goes down, the ability of the current assets to earn on their investments is assumed to go down. So those two are basically the same. So if we're talking about, say, a 3% assumed rate of return, we need a lot more assets under investment in order to cover off the benefit liabilities because they're expected to earn only at a 3% rate. There is a difference between the actuarial assumption and the assumption that's used for other purposes, such as financial reporting. We're looking at changing the actuarial assumption to 7.5%, so that's the assumption the actuary will use on how well the assets will do going into the future over the amortization period.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Ms. Lincheski, the assumed rate of return, when you take a look at, say, a 10-year, 20-year average, which is what most people do when they're looking at how they're going to invest for their retirement and so forth, how does assumed rate of return of 8.5% compare to the actual rate of return that's happened over 10 or 20 years?
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Representative Fabian, Chair. If we look at a 30-year horizon, we are about at 7.5%, which is where we want to go in our bill, so that we go from 8 or 8.5, where it's currently for the plans, down to 7.5. We look out over this long horizon for actuarial purposes. If we look, say, back at last year's returns, we had a 15.1% return. The prior year, however, we were about flat. So over the long horizon that the plans use to determine their liabilities, we look at over the 30 years, it is about a 7.5% return. On a shorter period, it is not that high. It's a little less than that.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Final question. So, Ms. Lincheski, would you say that we would be doing a better job of meeting our, say, fiduciary responsibility by going to the 7.5%? I want to make sure that I'm on the right path here.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah, Representative Fabian. Fortunately, none of you are fiduciaries, so the plans are. So they have come forward, and they are seeking a reduction in their assumed rate of return from their current rate down to 7.5. So as fiduciaries, they believe that this needs to be adjusted, it does put the plans on firmer footing in that we believe we get a more accurate picture of where they are in terms of their funded ratio.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I had some questions along the the same line. On page 12, you show this assumes an investment rate of return of 7.5%. So the funding ratio then that shows up here in that second column, that's based on the 7.5. Am I correct on that in the way that footnote reads?
Ms. Lachesky.
Yes. Chair Nalbach, Representative Carlson, that is true. We're using a 7.5% assumption, based on the fact that we believe that that will be changed, or at least we hope that our bill will then make that change. If we use the current assumptions in the statute, which is 8% for all the plans except TRA, which is at 8.5%, the funded ratio looks better. So, for instance, it may be 5% better using an assumed rate of return that's higher than 7.5%.
Yeah, and Representative Mr. Chairman, you anticipated my next question, because when I look at your colorful yellow sheet here, it shows 8.5%. So my next for TRA is the highest one, and the rest of them are 8. But now you will make an adjustment, if I recall correctly, on July 1st this summer, reflecting what the past 5 years and that what that average has been. Is that the way that works?
Ms. Lynchewski?
Chair, Representative, no. We can only do what the statute tells us to do when we're running these actuarial valuation reports. So there's no adjustment that happens automatically. It will only be adjusted to 7.5 if the bill is enacted.
Yeah, Representative Carlson, are you talking
about
the market
value?
About
the return on the investment. It was my understanding that somewhere at the end of the fiscal year, I think, July 1st, that you do a look back and make an adjustment as to what your stock market and other investment earnings have been. And so looking at the history recently of the stock market, I assume that would impact on these unfunded numbers that you show here with the 7.5 when you have an actual return that's going to be, I think, higher than the 7.5 as of July 1st. And I understand the 7.5 is based on your proposal or the bill, but maybe just answering when that adjustment is made and how far back that look is when you deal with return on investment.
Ms. Lynchewski.
Yeah, Chair, Representative, I think you're talking about the quadrennial experience studies that each of the plans do. So every 4 years, they take a look at how actual experience, how consistent it is with the assumptions. Assumptions include the investment rate of return. It includes mortality, how many people retire each year, those sorts of things. So we do a study every 4 years. And that the next study, I believe, would be done in FY 2019. And then we would take a look at those assumptions that are being used and check to see how close they are to experience and then adjust accordingly.
July 1st of 2019, is that when the study is completed then?
The study will be effective as of that date, but it won't be completed until several months after that date.
Mr. Chairman, the study starts then. Okay. I'll stop there then. I'm just trying to get a handle on how this impacts on the funding ratio once that study is complete. I said 5 years, so it's 4 years that you do that, and I thought it was coming up this July 1st. But okay.
Ms. Lachesky, I've got a couple questions along those lines, too, if I can. Now, I think it seems to me that I see that these funded ratios you've got on that page, you know, going back, I guess, a page, are based on market value of assets. And I think that at least you used to do them based on some sort of five-year smoothing, given that, the rate of return in the stock market bounces around a lot. Is that the way we still do them by law, or did we switch to market?
Chair Nalbach, good question. We actually show that both ways in the actuarial valuation. So it is true that there is an actuarial valuation, or excuse me, an actuarial value of assets that is a smoothing, and it does work that way. It reduces the impact of volatility on the asset performance. So that is true. So if you looked at our, say, the valuations for each of the plans, you would see it reported as both actuarial value and market value. There's not a big difference between them. It's about 1%. We show it as market here, but we certainly could have shown it as actuarial, and you wouldn't see a lot of difference in these funded ratios.
Okay, I'm pleased to hear that, because I know one time there was a fair difference between the smooth ratio and the market ratio. So they're pretty close. I'm wondering if you could maybe provide to the committee, you know, just based on what the current law is, what these funded ratios are. Because I think we should know, you know, what the current law is versus, you know, these at 7.5. And maybe you could have the, you know, the smooth ratio as well as the market value then. And then I guess if I can, following up, you know, you mentioned that, you know, it would be nice to be at, you know, 90% or 95%, you know, obviously. Is there the bigger the better, I suppose, but is there some reason that you wouldn't shoot to be at 100%, that you'd rather, you know, that as a general rule, you'd shoot to be at 90 or 95%?
Chair Knobloch, I think it's what realistically can be accomplished. The statute defines the contributions that go into the plans, and I think sort of politically speaking, it is difficult to increase those contributions. I think, you know, you're right that the higher we can get in terms of the funded ratio, the better. But it's not clear that there's a lot of payoff for getting there. So, for instance, the credit rating agencies haven't really been concerned if we were over, say, 80% funded on our plans, at least historically, and that's what I understand is the case. So there's probably not a big payoff to getting that close to, you know, full funding.
Well, there's not a big payoff, I guess, as far as the credit rating agencies go, but we just said, well, we're going to be happy at 85%, you know, presumably if all stock market predictions in terms of rate of return and everything come true, I mean, at some point, either the state or employees or both are going to have to come forward and put in more money, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Chair Knobloch. It is over a long period of time, you know, that we're looking at, 30 years, so you'd have to, I think, get down to, you know, below 50% in order for there to be a real sense of urgency about doing that, but it is true. The other thing is there's the compounding effect of having assets invested. So the quicker we get more money in, the quicker we can earn a return on those investments. So,
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when I was asking my questions earlier, I think I was mixing the four-year study with what you're calling the smoothing. Mm-hmm. Just a follow-up question to my earlier ones and what you were asking about, Mr. Chairman. When do we find the most recent five-year smoothing? I don't know if that's a pension term, but I'll pick up on what the chairman is using. I think I used average when I was mixing the two together a few minutes ago.
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Carlson. We report the actual value or the smoothing value of the assets in the annual reports for the plans. So the annual valuation provides that information. I don't know if historically, or as Chair Knobloch was mentioning, there must have been some, that must have been an issue for the commission and for the legislature. Right now, there isn't much of a difference between the actuarial value and the market value of assets. And I suppose it's because we've been very close to the assumed rate of return over the five-year period. But that hasn't been an issue that I'm aware of.
Representative Carlson.
I guess I'm not asking it in the sense of an issue. I'm asking when the next report would come on the five-year averaging or smoothing.
Representative Carlson, every year they display what the actual value is. So every year they do that calculation and set it out in the annual valuation for each of the plans.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, does that match our fiscal year then, or is that a calendar year? Or I'm just trying to get a handle on, being that pensions will be an issue when that report comes out.
Ms. Lynchowski.
Representative Carlson, Chair Knobloch. The fiscal year ends June 30th, so that's when it would come out. But it's always available, so it's not as if we sort of do an issue and it's something that comes out periodically. It comes out every year, and you can always find out what that actual valuation is, or actual actuarial value of assets as compared to market value of assets.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, then when I reference July 1st or June 30th, that's when we would formally see it, I think, is what you're saying, and we could check right now and see what the return is, I think, is what Ms. Lynchowski is saying. Thank
you. So the next smoothing calculation happens at the end of our fiscal year, June 30th. It's not a calendar year smoothing.
Chair Knobloch, that is correct.
All right. Okay. And I guess one other question on this whole rate of return, because it has had a lot of discussion going from, 8% to 7.5%. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the investment world that, the stock market is really highly valued. If you look at price-to-earnings ratios, that if you look at the bond market, the rates are on the way up, which would tend to reduce the value of bonds as interest rates go up. Do you have a sense, do you have a sense of what other states have done? I mean, what's the lowest you've seen in terms of other states saying, well, maybe even 7.5% is too much? We think it ought to be lower. What are you seeing in the national market?
Chair Knobloch, we are watching that all the time. The CalPERS is the largest public pension plan out in California. They are moving down. I believe they have adopted a 7% rate of return. The actuaries for the plans have opined that we are on the high end of the range, so they have given us a range of what is reasonable for the assumed rate of return, and we're at 7.5 when we go there. We will be on the high end of the range. So I think it is true that the trend is downward. California kind of leads the pack in terms of these kinds of changes, and we're looking at that closely and seeing that they are going down to 7% assumed rate of return.
And if 7.5 is on the high end, what's the low end?
Chair Knobloch, I don't think I've seen anything lower than 6.5 or so with the big public pension plans. I'd say about 6.5.
All right. Thank you. All right. Please proceed.
So the last couple of slides are really for the benefit of the legislators, just in case anybody's interested in your own pension plan, which isn't actually a pension plan. It is a defined contribution plan. So you all are, if you were elected for the first time after July 1, 1997, you were all members of the unclassified plan. You are required to contribute 5.5% of salary. The legislature then contributes 6%. That goes into an account in your name. And when you retire or when you end your service as a legislator, you are able to take out that account. And you could take it out in a lump sum. If you're over 55 or 55 or over, you can also, or in lieu of a lump sum, you can elect an annuity distribution. As noted at the bottom of the page, slide 14, if you were first elected prior to July 1, not 2997, but 1997,
yeah.
Sorry about that. This was late last night, so. So if you're elected before July 1 of 1997, then you would be in the pension plan, and the contributions to that are higher, but then you do get a pension benefit at the end when you retire.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just had a question about that. I noticed on another slide that there are, in this, for legislators, that per diem during session is counted as part of salary for purposes of the pension, that there's a match from the state and that there's a deduction from the per diem, I assume. So I'm just curious about that because, just to flag this for other members, so it says that that doesn't count for per diem except during the regular session, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I didn't know about until recently. I'm just curious about why that is. I mean, it doesn't seem – it's just a curious kind of decision that the one thing is in and the other thing is out. And what it really means is that when we get per diem, we're actually getting more than meets the eye because there's this match by the state for our contribution to our pension. So is there, can you give us the history on that? What's going on there?
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Liebling, I don't know what the history is, but we certainly could find that out. Also, there is a little bit of discrepancy sometimes between what the statute says and what is actually happening in practice. And so I think this would be a good topic to check in with MSRS and see if, in fact, the statute matches what is being done. And we certainly could find out how it was that this policy decision was made, that certain per diem would be included and not other per diem, such as during the interim.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that. I really would, you know, I think you got our attention when you said that something might be happening that's different from what the statute says. I mean, that's a good way to get legislators' attention. So that would be really good to understand. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, a little bit in my memory of the history of that. A representative by the name of Wayne Seminole, who was on the Pension Commission as well as chair of the Appropriations Committee, as we called it then, was the author of that provision. I don't recall who would have been on the Senate side. But what was happening was that there had not been for many years a legislative pay increase. And so that was an attempt by Representative Seminole and others. I wasn't involved in the issue, but I was here to reflect a lack of a legislative pay increase over a period of years. So that was a bit of the reasoning behind it, if I recall correctly. We do have a history, as we've learned more recently, of not adjusting legislative pay in a timely manner. The last time before the last pay increase, if you members will recall, was 1998, so that was a 20-year period. So it was an attempt to have the pensions reflect that lack of adjustment. And before 1998, there had also been a long period without legislative pay adjustments.
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Carlson, we will provide that information. I can't comment on your recollection of how that happened, but we certainly can check into that with MSRS and get back to you on it. And that may be the case. That may be what happened then.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't the one asking for the history. I think that was another member.
All right.
Okay.
But thank you. Yeah, I think Representative Liebling asked for it, but sure, if we could get the history, that'd be great.
And okay, that's really please. All my comments.
Did you have anything else? I guess the rest of what you had in terms of the Pension Commission, did you want to make any comments on that on your slides?
Yeah, sorry, Chair Knobloch. There are a couple more slides here. I had thought that I had finished with the unclassified, but there are a couple slides on our commission. I don't know if any of you, we have a couple members here. So Representative Vogel, Representative Anderson are on the commission. It is a 14-member commission. 7 are from the House. 7 are from the Senate. We've got a five from the majority party and from each House, and then 2 from the minority party. It's been around for a long time, since the 1960s. It does deal with retirement-related issues, so anything dealing with the pension plans and other retirement issues will go to the Pension Commission and be considered. And then it's an informal referral to the commission. The committee of record for these bills is the State Government Operations Committee. The chair of the commission this biennium is Senator Rosen. The vice chair is Representative O'Driscoll.
Okay, and I've got Representative Fabian wanted to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lincheski, you mentioned, I believe in your comments, you said that the previous two pension bills were vetoed. What's the net effect to the taxpayers and what we have to do to try to come forward with a new bill now in this session? How much additional money is required from us as a legislature to overcome the two previous vetoes?
Ms. Lincheski.
Chair Knobloch, Representative Fabian, we could get you those numbers. We have asked the plans to provide those numbers. What it has meant in just a general sense is that there were contribution increases and state aids in the 2017 omnibus pension bill that was vetoed. That means that we don't have those dollars in the pool of assets being invested over at the State Board of Investment. So for the earnings that we are seeing for this year, those assets are not there to earn on. So I'm not sure what the exact dollar amounts are, but we can get that for you. The 2016 bill did not have contribution increases in it. It did have COLA reductions. So we, since 2016, have been paying COLAs, or cost of living increases, on retiree benefits that we wouldn't have had to pay had that bill not been vetoed in 2016. So there's both some savings that we would have achieved as well as some additional dollars in.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And full disclosure, I'm drawing a pension right now, but I'm not as much as former Representative Cornish was. But I'd be interested, too, then, Ms. Lincheski, in what is the effect in the tails on that as well. Thank you.
Ms. Lincheski, I wanted to ask a question on the sort of summary, I think you call it a cheat sheet or something like that, that had all this information on it. And I appreciate this. I've never seen it laid out in this sort of format before, and I appreciate that. When I look at the average annual pension of a person in the, say, the basic plan versus the coordinated plans, obviously the basic plans go back a ways. You know, obviously the earnings or the average pension's a lot higher for the basic member because they were being compensated for not getting Social Security. But as you look at the average annual pension, I mean, other than COLAs, do you see those numbers going up significantly over time? And I guess I ask that because of the fact that, okay, you know, the people that are in these pensions, the coordinated plans, obviously have, you know, less seniority than those who are in the basic plans, who are probably almost all retired. Would you see that changing a lot over time, or would a person just pretty much assume that other than the COLAs, that'd be about where you'd be?
Chair Knobloch, do you mean whether the basic membership will increase, or the basic pension?
No, whether the average annual pension for the coordinated members will rise a lot, because I would assume that. Well, that's my question, whether that would rise a lot or whether it would be mostly just tied to a COLA.
Chair Knobloch, I think that is a fair statement, that the increases will just be attributable to the COLA. There are, of course, slight increases in everybody's salaries, and those assumptions, I think, are around 2% a year is about what the actuaries are using, or at least seeing, for increases in salary and payroll growth. So there will be some increase, but it is mostly attributable to the COLAs. The current omnibus pension bill does reduce COLAs, so that will have an impact on the rate at which these will increase, but probably not significantly so.
Okay. And Ms. Lincheski, do you know what percentage of our state general fund in total goes into pensions? I've heard that some states that have got some real serious problems in the Illinois, like Illinois, have something like 25%, I think is one number I saw in the media, 25% of their general fund going to support pensions in one form or other. Do you know what that number is for Minnesota?
Chair Knobloch, I would have to report back to you, but I might look over at Mr. Marks and see if he would like to give a little bit of information on that point.
I know it's a question out of the blue. Mr. Marks, you have any idea?
Mr. Chair, I don't. There would be the direct contributions to the pension plans that that are made, but typically that's through agency budgets. We'd have to search out those numbers, and then where there are supplemental appropriations, such as the appropriations to the St. Paul teachers or so on, those numbers are more obvious, but we can see what we can find.
Well, thank you. I would like to know what that number is. I think it would be useful for us to know, and I don't know if there's any national data on what other states do and how they compare, but there are some states that have gotten into some real serious trouble with their pensions, and, you know, we obviously need to be careful about that, and I think it would be good for us to know that. Other questions for Ms. Lincheski or Ms. Barth? All right. Looks like we maybe are just going to be a little bit early in being done today, but we're not quite done because, of course, we have House File 3147 that we'll be taking up after session subject to referral. So I'm going to recess us to the call of the chair, watch for an announcement on the floor. Representative Carlson.
You just maybe answered the question, but you said the Republicans were going to get together before we meet, and I was planning on doing the same with the Democrats, but what kind of a window will we have there for our caucus meetings?
Well, I'm thinking that we're not going to be spending a lot of time on the floor today, so, I mean, you know, if we had this, you know, if we go into session at 3:30 and if it, you know, takes a half an hour, I'm thinking we could then, you know, immediately have each of our respective parties caucus, and that's why I was kind of thinking of 5 o'clock. But if it got done really quick, I mean, we can talk on the floor and, you know, maybe move it up a little bit, or if for some reason it draws on longer, we might have to push it back.
I was just wondering if I should plan on 15 minutes, half hour.
Oh, I think you should be able to have a half hour anyway for your caucus.
I'll need a half hour, but
yeah.
Take it. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Seeing no further questions, we are in recess to the call of the